Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
They killed our daughter. They almost killed us. They destroyed our house.
Survivors of Beirut's port explosion condemn authorities and line up to leave a failing state. I'll speak to George Catani, head of the Lebanese Red Cross, and to journalist Robin Wright about Iran's influence and what its new president means for the United States. Then,
I do believe that fighting for the right to vote is as American as apple pie.
Access to the ballot is once again under threat in America on the 56th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. I break down the danger to democracy with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin and author Julius Fye. Plus, his state has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country. Now, Louisiana Governor John Edwards tells Walter Isaacson about his plan to get the COVID crisis under control. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Rage and reflection across Beirut today, 1 year since the deadly port explosion. It was one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in history, sparked by dangerous chemicals sitting neglected for years. More than 200 people were killed, thousands were injured, and countless more still bear the invisible wounds, inflamed by the lack of accountability and unanswered questions. Today, fed-up residents clashed with Lebanese security forces, and President Biden announced $100 million in additional aid, and he called out Lebanese authorities.
No amount of outside assistance will ever be enough if Lebanon's own leaders do not commit to do the hard but necessary work of reforming the economy and combating corruption. That's essential.
It's a vital part of the world, even for the United States. And correspondent Ben Wiedemann now brings us the very human story of that terrible day.
Nurse Pamela Zeynoun was on the phone with her mother. At 8 minutes past six in the evening, Beirut's nightmare began. Pamela in the ward for premature babies didn't hesitate.
I was very focused to save the babies.
With three babies in her arms, she walked for an hour and a half to find an incubator. While Pamela was walking, the injured flocked to her severely damaged hospital, the Saint-Georges, where the explosion had killed four nurses. On that awful evening, more than 6,000 people were wounded, more than 200 killed. A city that over the decades has been through wars, car bombs, and terrorism had never seen anything on this scale. A year later, and most of the rubble has been cleared, some of the damage has been repaired, yet deep scars remain.
I know a lot of my colleagues, they are still on medications, they are still having a very hard time sleeping or eating, or they still are remembering what happened, so it's really tough.
Paul and Tracy Najjar lost their three-year-old daughter, Alexandra, in the blast. Like many here, they blame the disaster on Lebanon's political elite.
Yes, last year after the blast, we decided to leave, which is a normal decision. You know, they killed our daughter, they almost killed us, they destroyed our house.
They're still here. Paul was recently elected to the Order of Engineers and has become a vocal advocate for change and accountability. Accountability that, until now, remains elusive. Ilyas Malouf lost his 32-year-old son, Georges, who was in the port when the blast happened. He regularly joins vigils with other relatives of the dead, demanding justice. Every day his mother cries and cries, Ilyas tells me. She asks, why doesn't Georges come over for coffee? Why doesn't he come over for the weekend? The port blast is just one catastrophe visited upon Lebanon, which in the last 2 years has seen unrest, political paralysis, financial and economic collapse, and the COVID pandemic.
All of this, when the explosion happened, was full of rubble.
Hani and Kiana have come back to their old flat overlooking the port.
Hani, most of his injuries were on his right side, and he crouched here like this. So that's why you can still see all of his blood.
Both were wounded by flying glass, scarred and traumatized. Hani and Kiana are leaving Lebanon.
If we would see an immediate future, then we wouldn't leave.
Lebanon's future is dark. The jarring images of a year ago seared into the memories of everyone who lived through it. The nightmare isn't over.
Ben Wiedemann reporting there on the tragedy a year ago and the brain drain now. George Kitani has been Secretary General of the Lebanese Red Cross for 8 years, and he's joining me from Beirut. George Kitani, welcome. I mean, it must be awful for you to see, even today on the anniversary, what's happening in the streets, to hear about the lack of accountability, the brain drain. The Red Cross has been on the front line for decades, and you've been leader for the last couple of decades. How are you feeling today about what seems to be a failing state now?
As Lebanese Red Cross, and according to the fundamental principles of Red Cross Crescent, we are trying to give a hope with the support of the movement of Red Cross Crescent to continue supporting the community. And this is our challenge, how we can give hope to the vulnerable people. When we start responding 1 year ago, and it was a tragedy, a disaster, we don't know what happened, what's going on. And we evacuate at night only, I'm not talking the second day, or the 2,600 treated and evacuated, and between them some COVID cases from ICU. You know, there's 4 or 5 hospitals destroyed. And also we try to help the community in giving cash for 11,000 families. So we at Lebanese Red Cross, we try to complement and to help the community, saving lives and protecting the dignity of the community. This is what we are trying in primary health and ambulance service, blood for hospitals also and for these people, and of course in relief, and especially, and as you mentioned in your programs, in mental health, psychosocial support, and restoring family links.
Mm-hmm. You know, George Kitani, you're trying to give help. Obviously, that's what the Red Cross does around the world, and you're trying to give hope. You saw in our report from Ben Wiedemann that hope is in very short supply. I want to ask you about the role of the Red Cross. I mean, you know, you have provided something like 80% of the ambulance services in a country where 80% of the hospitals and medical centers are private. This is stuff that the government should be doing, not necessarily the Red Cross. Explain what it takes when the Red Cross suddenly becomes the main public health sector.
The Red Cross, after the civil war, was replacing the government, especially the Minister of Health, through an agreement in ambulance service. You call 140, like 911, the Red Cross will respond. But the Red Cross are independent, neutral, and impartial to try to be accepted and respected and trusted by the community. Also, we are leading in the blood bank, where we have 13 blood banks in the country. And as I mentioned before about the primary health and support and disaster management and relief and others, the role of the Red Cross in general, the role of the movement of Red Cross Red Crescent and supported by the Federation, International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent and ICRC, International Committee, and our movement of Red Cross, we are trying always, as I say, to complement and to help the community. Our role is to give, to protect this dignity. And as you mentioned, when the government or the state will reduce their mission, we will increase our response. And we try always not to interfere in politics and not to interfere with any parties. And this is why we are accepted from the south, Shabaa, to the Wadi Khalid, to the north, where we have a safer access, neutral, independent, impartial, supported by our movement of Red Cross and Red Crescent. I will not forget the Lebanese abroad. I will not forget the companies, the donors, any donors, individual donors who are helping us to maintain the support, especially now, as you mentioned, There's a big problem regarding the health sector. The health sectors and the economic sector and the social sector, where there's a big tragedy and a big challenge. And like the chronic medicines, like the people who want to go to the hospital, they cannot support. And you see, if you realize the inflation of dollars, how much the inflation of Lebanese pound, how much it's so expensive, mm-hmm. how much it costs too much to the community. The Red Cross is there to try to reduce and to minimize these problems and to give a small hope and to tell them, we are with you, we are neutral, we have to help you, we are here to help you from any country, not only for the blast, from the north, the south, the Bekaa, and Mount Lebanon and Beirut.
Very finally, do you have hope? And how frustrated are you?
Frankly, it's not easy. When you don't have, as a human being, as a person in Lebanon, I don't have electricity 24 hours. I don't have access like before. What's about the school, education, what's about the universities, what's about others. But we have to give hope to the community. We want them to stay and to see how we can together respect the rules and regulations, trying to support anyone who needs any support. We cannot leave them. They will see us as a hope. They will see us as a backup to them. And the spirit of the Red Cross, the volunteers of the Red Cross, they realize how much they are protecting and helping the community. This is the challenge for us, how we can maintain our volunteers and how we can protect the community to continue in supporting them. We cannot do everything. We need to share this support with others. We are not alone. There's a lot of other NGOs, but at Lebanese Red Cross, as national societies supported by the movement, we want to give hopes and supported by the states abroad, by the governments, by the community, by the Lebanese abroad, we can give this hope.
George Kitani, thank you so much for joining us, head of the Lebanese Red Cross. We appreciate it on this day. Now, the brain drain that we've just been mentioning is not just a problem for Lebanon, but also for Iran. The Islamic Republic wields enormous influence there through its proxies, Hezbollah, and it now finds itself at its own crossroads. A new hardline president takes office tomorrow. Talks to revive the nuclear deal seem to be on life support. And today, Israel blamed an Iranian commander for a deadly drone attack on an oil tanker. Escalating tensions, of course. Journalist Robin Wright has covered Iran extensively, as well as Lebanon and much of the region, and she's joining me now from Washington. Robin, welcome back to the program. You know, you heard George Kitani from his own perspective talking about being neutral, talking about bringing hope and sustenance to all sides. Tell us, though, how Lebanon has moved away from kind of consensus politics with each different identity and religion represented to now pretty much Hezbollah being in charge and calling the shots.
Well, Hezbollah is obviously one of the most important parties. And of course, it is the largest militia outside of the Lebanese army. It is in many ways defining national security because it repeatedly has taken pot shots at Israel. And one of the tensest front lines in the Middle East is between Lebanon and Israel today. The tragedy of Lebanon, and I lived there for 5 years during the Civil War, is that the politicians, who are also the old warlords, are still fighting each other in the same way they did in the 1970s and 1980s, only this time through politics. And the country is deadlocked, and it is indeed a failing state. It's one of the great travesties because this was the first nascent democracy. It was the one place where Christians and Muslims lived side by side, celebrated the religious holidays together. And today, it is a country that is almost beyond salvation.
So, Robin, let me ask you what you think is going to happen to Lebanon and maybe to Iran, because there are reports that amid escalating tensions in the region, there has been heavy artillery fire from Lebanon into Israel. And it's presumably, although I don't know whether it's been named that yet, from the south where Hezbollah have their positions. That on top of Israel naming and calling out the Iran Revolutionary Guard commander for unmanned vehicles for that attack on the Mercer Street, the ship in which two people were killed a few days ago. How badly do you think that, well, how close do you think that we are to an escalation of maybe even military action in that, you know, region that can ill afford it?
I think we are at a crossroads in the Middle East, in part because of Iran's tensions with Israel, both directly and through its allies and proxies like Hezbollah. We're reaching a point that over the past year, whether it's the kind of maritime tensions playing out among tankers, the attacks on tankers, and by both sides, is reaching an unprecedented point. You've also seen the strikes on each other's drones. There is a sense that Iran has become the hegemon in the region, both because it is a military power, not just because it's close to a nuclear nuclear threshold, but because it has the most advanced and largest arsenal of missiles in the region. It has used its drones, its very sophisticated drones, against an Israeli tanker that we're at a point that without a nuclear deal, without something to diffuse these tensions and indicate that diplomacy is an alternative, that the dangers of an escalation across the region are very high. It may be pot shots here and there. It may not be the kind of open conflict we've seen in the past, but this doesn't make it any less dangerous.
So then let's, what do you think? I mean, you've covered it as much as anybody, of the chances of a nuclear deal. Clearly, both sides wanted it. The Biden administration wanted to go back into the deal that Trump pulled out of. The Iranians wanted it because of the sanctions, etc. But now it looks like it's definitely hanging by a thread. You've got this hardline Ebrahim Raisi, who's about to be, sworn in tomorrow. And you've got the Secretary of State of the United States saying the following. Blinken said a few days ago, talks on the nuclear deal with Iran cannot and will not go on indefinitely. What information do you have about whether this is going to happen and whether Raisi wants it to happen?
I think there's increasing pessimism in Washington. There had been hope that while the negotiations would be tough, that they would reach a point where they could compromise and revive one of the most important nuclear deals in more than a quarter century. And after six sessions, the United States proposed in June a package that the previous government took back to Tehran, and the hardliners, sensing their emergence and control of foreign policy as well as domestic policy, basically rejected. And so the United States, frankly, doesn't know when the next session might be or even if there is a next session. And the danger is, as Blinken indicated, that the talks, this kind of twilight zone of diplomacy, can't continue forever because by the end of the year, Iran will have crossed the threshold of having enough enriched uranium to fuel a weapon. That doesn't mean it will have a weapon, but it means it's crossed that pivotal threshold that the United States has spent years trying to prevent. There's a new crowd in Tehran as hardline, the most zealous wing of the hardline faction now is control of most of the instruments of power, be it the three branches of government, the intelligence, the military. And the danger is that they take a much harder position that makes some kind of compromise ever more difficult, maybe even impossible. And that, where does that leave anybody? And is the only way to defuse this and prevent Iran from getting a bomb some kind of kinetic action, whether it's by, Israel or the United States or a coalition? And this is a very nasty, nasty alternative, because I think a war with Iran or even some kind of conflict could end up being messier than our engagements in either Afghanistan or Iraq.
You know, let's just, remind everybody that for a couple of years during the life of that nuclear agreement, it was working certainly for both sides, that Iran was keeping to its deal. And the Trump administration gambled that they could cause regime collapse or whatever by pulling out of the deal. And instead, as you say, it has now, after 14 months after Trump pulled out, trying to see whether it could get back into the deal, Iran has upped its uranium enrichment. Again, this is very bad news for those who wanted that arms control agreement. Do you see Ebrahim Raisi as a hardline revolutionary and a human rights violator who's been sanctioned personally by the United States and by other entities ushering perhaps a return of the really even worse old days of the Ahmadinejad regime, constantly aggressive, constantly on the offensive, you know, no sense of trying to be diplomatic or in any sense of having a nuclear arms control deal?
Potentially worse than the Ahmadinejad era. This is a man who has no political experience, no economic or foreign policy experience. He has said very little beyond that he wants to return to the deal. He wants sanctions lifted. But the question is, of course, under what terms? And the danger is that he is influenced by others who are in the military, in the intelligence community, in his own new foreign policy team, who do have some experience and want to present tougher demands on the United States that are unacceptable to Washington and potentially even the other partners in the nuclear deal. The dangers, Christiane, are not just that Iran gets closer to a bomb, but that once, if Iran begins to cross that threshold, that other powers in the neighborhood, Saudi Arabia and beyond, try in turn to get their own weapons, that we would enter an era of the proliferation of a nuclear weapon, which so many people spent the second half of the 20th century trying to avoid. The nuclear deal was important, not just diffusing tensions between the United States and Iran, but in stopping or containing the spread of nuclear weapons in general.
Inside, again, you're a very keen observer. You've reported a lot on that. What do you make of the current protests, long-standing protests against this terrible drought, a lack of water, actually coming out and blaming the supreme leader and calling for water, basically? There's a huge amount of discontent on the streets. Where do you think that will lead under a new hard-line government, harder-line government?
Well, Raisi is inaugurated this week amid one of the hottest summers in the last half century. More than 300 cities, about a quarter of Iran's municipalities, are finding water is very scarce. The protests have erupted in one of the oil-rich provinces and then spread to more than six provinces. The government has cracked down, arrested people. Nine people are at least documented to have died. This is a problem that Iran can't solve immediately between the drought and terrible mismanagement of water and natural resources, that this will play out for some time. The internet has been cut off in some of these areas, and it's very hard to tell actually what's happening. It's a hot summer, as you know better than anyone. Temperatures rise in August, and this is a hot summer both politically and physically for the Islamic Republic.
One of the most difficult parts and challenging parts of the world right now. Thank you so much indeed, Robin Wright. Now, the United States, of course, has long clashed with Iran over a number of issues, including human rights and democracy, of course. And this week marks the 56th anniversary of America's Voting Rights Act, signed by President Johnson. But that landmark legislation is now under assault. At least 18 states have enacted laws restricting ballot access, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, leaving democracy hanging in the balance. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin once worked for LBJ and is the author of No Ordinary Time. Julius Feig has written a biography of LBJ's secret weapon, which was his wife. It's called Lady Bird Johnson Hiding in Plain Sight. And we welcome both of them to the program. Doris Kearns Goodwin, let me start by asking you to frame the discussion in the framework that we're all looking at, which is democracy and voting rights, no matter where it is. But in the United States, on Friday, it'll mark 56 years since Johnson ushered in the Voting Rights Act. Solid for the future, Doris Kearns Goodwin, or hanging by a thread?
It's a very worrisome thing. There's no question that what LBJ said when he signed that act, and I was actually in the House of Representatives just as an intern when that act was signed. It was so exciting. We knew that something had changed, that the manipulations that were being used by the southern states were going to have federal authority to look over them and determine whether or not something was happening. And there was a sense in which Johnson said the most basic right of all is the right to vote, without which all the other rights are meaningless. This is not a Negro right, not a white right, not a Northern right, not a Southern right. It's an American right. It's not a moral issue, he said. It is simply wrong to deny fellow Americans the right to vote. And how heartbreaking it is to see that between the Supreme Court decision and Shelby, that all the states are now going back to these voter suppression laws. It's the most fundamental thing we have to fight for today. It's for everybody in this country. You diminish the right of some, you diminish the right of all. I couldn't care more about any issue than this.
And we were just watching pictures of you that day or that time with LBJ. You were, you know, such a young woman 56 years ago, much younger, obviously. And he was practically bent double listening to you. Also one of the rare women, and you're framed there between the president and Lady Bird. I want to turn to Julius Feig, who's just written that amazing biography of Lady Bird Johnson, raising this woman who knew that she was called Claudia Taylor Johnson? You know, she was always known as Lady Bird, somewhat diminishing, somewhat sort of doll-like, maybe in terms of historical record. But nobody knew what a political weapon she was for her husband, the president. Just fill us in a little bit on the spine of your story.
Well, it's wonderful to be here with Doris and with you, Christian, and I think Lyndon Johnson knew full well just what a potent and powerful human being she was. And he had a penchant for spotting brilliant, low-ego people. She was one of them. And by the time they got into the White House, had become, and certainly with the transition after the JFK assassination, his most important advisor in the White House. The arc of the story that I tell is drawn from Lady Bird Johnson's, what I call the other LBJ tapes, her own audio record that she kept the entire time she was in the White House, and then goes straight through her role in mapping out the strategy that LBJ followed for a decision made and announced in March of 1968 that he wouldn't run a second time. We cover the gamut of civil rights, Great Society, Vietnam, environmentalism, importantly, which, like her name, Lady Bird, was concealing a far more substantive environmental vision that she attempted to enact over the course of her time in the White House.
Yeah, and it was a political partnership. We'll get to a little bit more of that in a minute, Julia.
Very much so.
I want to play, because you refer to these, these tapes, who really nobody knew about until you've brought them out. They were there, but they weren't sought out. So in 64, just ahead of the signing of the Voter Rights Act, she went on a train trip to certain southern states. And I think it was called, I want to just say that it was called the Lady Bird Special. And this is a soundbite that is about that. And I just want to talk about it in a sec.
What do I think I and my little trip into the South can do about it? Nothing much. Just sort of to say that whatever your feelings now and for the years to come, the South, to this Democratic candidate for president and to his wife, is a respected and valued and beloved part of the country.
Doris, that is an amazing reveal. It's an amazing discovery. It's an amazing piece of the historical archive that's come out now. You were there. We showed pictures of you, obviously, and the president and the first lady. Tell us from your perspective whether it was known then how politically significant she was, and she wasn't just only about beautification and wildflowers.
No, it's wonderful looking back at this history through these new tapes and Julia's book. I mean, clearly what was known then, when she made that whistle-stop tour through the South, she was talking about a new South. It wasn't just a South she was proud of, but a new South that, after the Civil Rights Act was passed, would become more a part of the nation. She got a lot of blowback from that. She got things saying, you know, Lady Bird, Black Bird, go home. There were death threats. There were bomb threats. And she kept going to the heart. And she won three out of, I don't know, she did, but LBJ won three out of the eight states that she traveled to. I mean, I saw her, you know, especially after the presidency was over, when I actually lived at the ranch, so I was in that house with her day after day. I saw the anchor that she was to her husband. There's no question. Without her, his life, I think, would have been inconceivable as a political figure. But what's so exciting about the new history that's opening up, not only from Julia, but I think from women. You know, first ladies used to be mentioned in the 19th century just as Mrs. Harrison or Mrs. Pierce. They weren't even mentioned by their full name. And now with all women writing about first ladies, writing about women's history, we're getting I'm an old person right now, and I'm thrilled at the idea that this new kind of literature is coming out. It needs documents, though, and I think that's why the finding of these secret tapes allows Lady Bird's voice through Julia to be exhibited. I mean, I heard that verse. I knew that verse. I did not know the extent to which she was involved in all these decisions that I now know. So I'm very thrilled to be part of an older person looking at younger people getting in this field and doing what we need to do all along. History comes from the ground up. It's not just first ladies. I think what women's involvement in history has brought is the citizen involvement in history as well. So it's an exciting time to be an historian and watching all this stuff that's going on. I commend Julia. There's a new book written on Nancy Reagan by Karen Tumulty. The same thing. She's come out as a figure in her own right because of the documents that are there. So it's great.
I'm going to delve a little bit more into who actually records history with you, Doris, but I want to do a turn quickly, obviously, about LBJ and Lady Bird to Julia. So we've talked a little bit about her civil rights train and what she and her husband obviously believe so much in. Remind us, though, she wrote a 9-page memo that you touched on describing why he should run in I think it was 64, and why he would not run again, 4 years later. And it was an extraordinarily prescient memo as a senior advisor. In fact, some of the press used to call her Madam Vice President, kind of, when there wasn't actually the vice presidential slot filled at the beginning of the Johnson presidency.
Correct. 1964 is a critical year. There was no vice president until, of course, the inauguration in January of 1965, when Humphrey was on the ticket. In early 1964, just 5 months into their time in the White House, Lyndon Johnson is looking around and he's got civil rights stuck in the Senate. He's got escalation in Vietnam and the pressure from Kennedy's War Council, whom he kept on board, to escalate. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, has gone to Vietnam 5 times already since the beginning of the year, and he's coming back to Washington. And LBJ knows, and Lady Bird understands too, that Vietnam might well derail their very ambitious domestic agenda.
Doris, you know, you mentioned first ladies, but I'm interested in your view of who's telling history, whether it's about first ladies or anybody. By and large, most of history, certainly, you know, that I've read in the past and now, is told by men. You are one of the rare major prominent award-winning presidential historians, but historians point blank, as a woman. Tell me about how it would change if there were more people of color, writing the history of what happened in America, not just slavery and civil rights, but in general writing history. What if there were more women, half the population, writing history? Do you ever think about that and how the narrative and the story of your country might be different?
I do think about that. I mean, I think one of the things that's happening right now, not only with the writing of history, but with the teaching of history, is that the understanding is the country as a whole. As I say, change has often come from the ground up. When I look at my guys that I wrote about, who are mostly the presidents, right? It's a top-down history that we used to have when I was in school, even when I was writing, except for luckily Franklin and Eleanor. I was able to have Eleanor equal partner because there were documents that documented her role. First lady to have a press conference, first lady to do daily columns, an extraordinary character. But I think the more women that get involved in writing, the more people of color that get involved in writing, we need to have a history that's all of our country, that tells the story from the beginning up, that sees the troubling parts, that deals with the issues of race, that deals with the issues of discrimination, and that also deals with the progress that has been made. And I think it's a healthy thing that we're having this debate right now, and that more people will be writing history who are people of color, who are people who've been discriminated against, and they can tell their story, and their story is part of our story.
So your guys are Lincoln, FDR, LBJ, and
Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt, exactly. Okay, so let's talk about one of the things that FDR did that you write about and that you're concerned about now that Biden is taking on, and that is the idea of massive infrastructure. Tell me the historical reason for that being so important and how you think the Biden attempt to pass a big infrastructure bill will turn out and what it will mean for the American, you know, for the state of the country and the history of the country.
I mean, what FDR understood when he first came into the presidency was that the most important thing was to get first the banking crisis solved, which is the equivalent of getting the vaccine to the people for Biden. But then the next thing was to get people not only jobs, not only temporary jobs, but permanent jobs. And that meant rebuilding the infrastructure of the country. So we had LaGuardia Airport, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Bonneville Dam, the TVA administration, a rural electrification. I mean, in a certain sense now, when Biden's talking about bringing broadband to rural areas, that's what FDR was doing, bringing electricity to rural areas that didn't have it, knitting the country together by having bridges and roads and divides. Do you know, even Abraham Lincoln, when he was 23 years old, the first time he ran for office, it was on infrastructure so that poor people could get their goods to market by roads and rivers and bridges. So I think the infrastructure thing is an extraordinary thing for the country as a whole. And then I think after that's done, if that's done, then the voting rights thing is still absolutely essential. If he can get all those things done between the COVID-19, infrastructure, and voting rights, it will be an historic presidency.
Doris, let me ask you a final question. One of the things I know that you hope is that a successful infrastructure and a successful, you know, realignment of what government can bring to the states and to the people might turn those who don't believe in government anymore back to believing in government. How do you think and how has that been eroded? Certainly since Reagan, when he just said that was one of the worst things you could imagine, you know, having faith in the federal government.
I mean, when you think about it, between the New Deal and World War II, and really up until the late 60s, something like 80% of the people believed that government would do the right thing most of the time. And then that began to erode with the credibility gap with Vietnam, then with Watergate, and then with Reagan having said that government was the problem, not the solution. And now the question is, if infrastructure were done correctly, if people began to feel that their daily lives were made better because government had done something that was important for them, would their trust in government begin to grow? Because what is government? Government's us. It's collective action. It's the belief that we can do things to make our country better. And if those combinations of things, if we get the virus under control, if indeed we get the infrastructure going so that people's daily lives are better, their community lives are better, their city lives are better, and we get voting rights, then maybe that will mean that trust in government has increased. Then that's a transformative thing in its own right.
Indeed. And we'll see about that with our next guest, because obviously it's been such a problem during COVID, the mistrust of government and how to, you know, really look after the whole of the United States. Doris Kearns Goodwin, Julius Feig, thank you both for joining us. So we turn now to Louisiana, which is experiencing its worst COVID surge yet, with an all-time high in hospitalizations. While the vaccination rate in Louisiana is among the lowest in the country, it is also now rising. Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards has reinstated a mask mandate in an effort to curb infections. And here he is talking to our Walter Isaacson about wrestling with the COVID crisis and what good government can do.
Thank you, Christian, and Governor John Bel Edwards, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Walter. It's good to be with you.
Louisiana is one of the worst hotspots now. More than 2,112 people are in the hospital. Tell us, what's the latest?
Well, first of all, unfortunately, we're not one of the hottest spots. We are the hottest spot as measured by the 7-day case rate. And quite frankly, it's not even close. Just the rate of growth in cases, which is fueling the hospitalizations, as you mentioned, and that 2,112 that we have admitted inpatients across the state of Louisiana who are dealing with COVID, that's the highest number throughout the pandemic. And what's really most concerning right now, Walter, is that the percent positivity of our test continues to increase. Today, we're going to announce that the percent positivity here is 15.4%. Last week, it was 13.2%. By the way, it hasn't been that high in over a year. And when it was higher, it was with 20% as many tests being conducted, almost all of which were being done in emergency departments early in the pandemic last year. Well, we're now testing 500,000 people a month, and we have that kind of positivity. And what we know is the first indicator that you are reaching the crest of the surge will be when that percent positivity levels off. And then, of course, we need it to go down. And so even though we have the worst numbers in the country, the worst numbers we've experienced in the pandemic, there is nothing on the horizon yet to indicate that things are about to get better, which is why we have reinstated the mask mandate to mirror the CDC recommendations for people five and over. And that includes our K-12 schools. It includes higher education. And this is for indoor public settings because we have to curb transmission. This Delta variant has been a real game changer. And quite frankly, we didn't do a good enough job of getting enough people vaccinated in the time that we had before this fourth surge really got started in earnest. And we are now paying the price. We're playing catch up as best we can. And the only good news I can report to you, Walter, is that over the last 3 weeks, our vaccinations have increased by about 300%. And in fact, I believe that in terms of week over week increase, we are leading the country in that regard right now with respect to new vaccinations. And so that is welcome, but we have a very, very long way to go.
So the news of this surge has caused people who were hesitant about vaccines to change their minds and say, I want vaccines?
Yes, and it's the news of the surge, but they actually, you know, the disease burden in every community across our state is so pronounced right now that just about everybody knows someone struggling with COVID. Either they're home sick, they're in the hospital sick, someone who recently died. I believe that that is getting traction and attention. And people who may have been hesitant, meaning they were waiting, they decided not to wait any longer. And some people who I think had initially said they were never going to get the vaccine have changed their mind. And so that's what we're seeing. We need to keep that going across Louisiana for quite a while, because quite frankly, only 37% of our state is fully vaccinated. About 43% have received at least one shot. And if there's other good news about that, Walter, it's this. At least as of right now, the vaccination rates in our nursing homes have been very good. And so we don't have nursing home patients competing for bed space in our hospitals, unlike at the beginning of the pandemic last year. And if we didn't have those vaccinations in place, we know that we would have just about an impossible task today to take care of people in our hospitals who need help. And Walter, this is a point that's lost on a lot of people. It isn't just the COVID patients who need space in the hospital. It's stroke victims. It's heart attack victims. It's people who've been in motor vehicle accidents and so forth. And when their hospitals are full, and when we say full, we might have empty beds, but what we don't have are the doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists to actually staff those beds. And that is an increasing challenge that we are trying to help our hospitals with every single day. I had a call yesterday with the medical directors of every tier one hospital in the state. Every region was represented, and they are all having the same issues. In fact, 46 hospitals, 46 in the state of Louisiana, have asked me to find help for them with respect to staffing. That's how acute things are in Louisiana today.
You come from rural Louisiana. Your mother was a hospital nurse, if I remember correctly. What are you hearing from people about why they're hesitant to get the exam, the vaccination, and what arguments are working?
Well, look, first of all, the reasons run the whole gamut, and the sources of misinformation out there are just so plentiful that it's hard to stay on top of. But many times it's people who are worried about fertility, or they say they don't know what's in the vaccine, or that it's experimental and so forth, or that they trust their own immune system. Believe it or not, we've had a health emergency, public health emergency here since March of 2020. We still have people who believe COVID isn't real.
Well, wait a minute. So, can they believe that now when everybody knows somebody's had COVID in Louisiana?
Yeah. Well, you know, the ones who get it, sometimes when they're told in the hospital, well, yeah, these respiratory symptoms you have, all these other things, it's because you're COVID positive. On occasion, these patients get angry because they say, no, I can't be COVID positive because COVID isn't real. But what
can you do about that misinformation?
Well, it's very difficult. We continuously try to put out good information and appeal to people. We have people who go to the hospital and once they realize they're in really bad shape and about to be intubated, they will ask, okay, please go ahead and give me the vaccine that I have thus far avoided. And they can't receive the vaccine at that point. And even if they did, it would be too late to do them any good. And so just working with people, you know, we had a very powerful press conference this past Monday. And it was the most powerful that I had seen. And Walter, the truth of the matter is, and I accept this, is that for those people who remain hesitant to get the vaccine, my voice is likely to make no difference. Because I've been talking about the need to be vaccinated for a very, very long time, and I do it every single day. But having healthcare providers who are in the trenches, who can relate personal stories and personal observations about just how bad this disease is and what this burden looks like in our state and how it's clogging up our hospitals and causing people to die. And not just exclusively in the COVID population, but if you have a stroke victim at a small rural hospital who cannot be transferred to a large tier one hospital where they can receive a higher standard of care, that outcome is likely to be poorer than it otherwise would be, to include death. And so having those people tell these stories, and including how many young people are being adversely affected. And that's one of the differences here with Delta, Walter. People need to understand about 20% of all the cases that we're announcing over the last few weeks are in people under 18. And they are and many young people, even those without pre-existing comorbid health conditions, are having much tougher times. And they're actually having the classic cases of COVID that involve respiratory problems and not just the multi-system inflammatory syndrome children, which is what we saw previously. So this is a very dire situation, and we're just trying to relate it to people as best we can, unvarnished, but using those people who are in the hospital to do that. It seems to be having some effect. But quite frankly, I am dismayed by the number of people who remain opposed to vaccines and how many people seem to be purposely undermining public confidence in things like vaccinations, in things like mitigation measures such as masking.
Give me some examples of that. Who is publicly trying to undermine you on vaccinations?
Well, unfortunately, the Attorney General here in Louisiana and you know, as if we don't already have religious and health and other reasons to opt out of a vaccine, he's talking about all the reasons that you can opt out of a vaccine if you want, as if we're even mandating it right now, which we're not as a state.
A Democratic governor, but you got a very conservative Republican attorney general who's trying to tell people how to opt out of vaccines.
And masking.
And have you talked to him? I mean, is there a way that you can reconcile this?
Well, I don't know how to do that. Quite frankly, I don't believe he's consulting with any public health experts. And what he's doing has no basis in the law. So it's very difficult to deal with him. And there are certain people who are going to listen to that. But what we have to do is minimize that number. Look, in-person education, for example, in our schools is so important. The learning loss last year because of COVID and so many people young children who were not in the classroom. And by the way, the test results came back this week and they were announced. We know that the kids who spent the most time in the classroom had the least amount of learning loss and they did much better. We want all of our kids in person in education, but it has to be a safe environment. And we know that you can't run a school if you're having outbreaks constantly. We've seen that in the summer term with respect to camps and other things where the kids were spreading COVID, the staff were getting it and so forth, and they were unmasked. And so we put the mask on mandate for school so that that can be a safe environment where the kids can learn, but they also have social and emotional needs to be in that classroom. Nutrition needs are satisfied when they go to school and for other reasons as well. And kids 12, under 12 don't even have access to a vaccine today. The vaccination rate from between kids between 12 and 18 is only about 13%. And so we have to do better. This is a CDC recommendation. And by the way, we don't want kids leaving school and going home to mom and dad and grandma and grandpa bringing COVID either.
You said that patients are having, for non-COVID issues, are having trouble getting treatment. Tell me what that has done.
Well, what it's done is it's caused people to not be able to get a bed in a hospital where they need to be in order to have a surgical procedure. But when you don't have the staffing available, they are having to postpone anything that isn't an emergency procedure, and whether it's surgery or medical. And what's not an emergency today can be an emergency next week if it's been delayed and so forth. And so this is really having an impact across the state of Louisiana. I know, for example, you know, you talked about my mother being a nurse. My sister is a nurse as well, and she works in Hammond, at the biggest hospital there. She's in her early 60s. She survived breast cancer. She has she's immunocompromised as a result of that, but she goes to work. And in fact, she's having to do extra shifts because that's what's required right now of the nurses. I have a niece who went to work on Sunday, Walker, and at a small rural hospital, they needed to transfer out a patient to an ICU. She personally called 38 hospitals in the state and out of state, could not locate an ICU for that patient. And we cannot pretend that that isn't affecting adversely the outcomes of these patients. And so that's how acute the situation is, which is why we need everybody on board to lower the transmission and let's turn this thing around again. And I believe we're going to get there. I'm an optimist, and I'm praying very hard. We're working very hard, but we need people to get on board. And quite frankly, I appreciate what the president started saying yesterday. If you're not going to lead in a positive direction, at least get the hell out of the way. And we need some people in Louisiana to get out of the way.
You're a Democratic governor in a conservative state, but you're very pro-life. How do you make the pro-life argument to the others in Louisiana?
Yeah, well, you know, and this is one of the things that I've always said. Pro-life, to me at least, has to be more than just simply anti-abortion. It has to be pro-life. And we've had over 11,000 people die. Yesterday alone, we announced 59 deaths in Louisiana. 4 weeks ago, we announced two in one day. And when you think about that, and you know that 90% of the people in the hospital are unvaccinated, and that if you simply vaccinate yourself, you're 25 times less likely to die from COVID, this does have a pro-life element to it. And I don't understand why that connection isn't being made, and that there isn't more of an effort across the entire political spectrum. But especially among the more conservative folks in Louisiana with respect to the pandemic. I mean, this is the biggest challenge for life anywhere in the world today, and it's manifesting itself right here in Louisiana in a way that we haven't seen up to now. And I am making appeals to people. I actually mentioned this in my press conference on Monday to try to get people to view it in this light. And I will be having a call with pastors from around the state tomorrow.
Governor John Bel Edwards, thank you so much, and good luck with your fight.
Walter, thank you so much. And we accept help, we accept prayers, and we're going to get through this. The people of Louisiana are good, decent, resilient people, and we're going to get through this. But, boy, I'm looking forward to cresting and starting to come down on this surge, because we are literally overwhelmed at the moment.
Well, good luck with it, sir.
Thank you.
And finally, despite the COVID spike in Japan, there have been many gee whiz moments this Tokyo Olympics. Talk about doing a frontside 180. If, like me, you don't know what that means, just look at British skateboarder Sky Brown, who went from learning tricks on YouTube to winning an Olympic bronze medal today. And she's only 13 years old. Britain's youngest ever Olympian, who grew up in California, said it was a super sick final. With the competitors cheering each other on, it was also a fine show of sportsmanship and marked a major comeback for young Sky after a serious life-threatening accident last year. And we might even see this prodigy making more waves on both the skateboarding and surfing podiums in the 2024 games. As Brown says, the girls are ripping it. By the way, Sky's 9-year-old brother is called Ocean. He's also a surfer skateboarder, and their YouTube channel has racked up 54 million views so far. Inspiring, to say the very least. And that's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.